This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you. From daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
The top stories from the KCBS Radio Newsroom. This is the All Local.
Health officials are sounding the alarm that tuberculosis cases are on the rise here in the U.S. as well as worldwide. And this has researchers puzzled, noting that this is a disease that has long been in the decline. For more, we're joined live on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline by Karen Dobos, microbiology professor at Colorado State University and director of the CSU Regional Biocontainment Lab. Professor, thanks for the time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I was, you know, baffled at the notion that measles were, you know, breaking out in Texas, and now this notion of TB. Where is it on the rise in the U.S. particularly, and then also nationwide, worldwide, and why?
Well, in the U.S., you know, it's puzzling why it's on the rise, but it would definitely be throughout the United States of America, especially in areas where you have centers of lower economic status. It is a disease of the poor, and so if you look to those areas, that's where you usually see an increase. Globally, there are several countries that continue to struggle with TB control: Indonesia, India, Nigeria, Bangladesh, China, and that represents about 50% of the global problem for tuberculosis, and continues to be some of the most challenging areas for control.
So it's mostly worldwide, not necessarily in the U.S.?
It is mostly a worldwide problem. Yeah, most of the cases occur outside of the United States and outside of the European communities.
Does this surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me. The history of TB is actually quite remarkable. It loves conflict. It loves malnutrition. It loves when people are struggling with other health conditions like diabetes, HIV, poor living conditions. And so whenever that creeps up, tuberculosis is always right there. It also is coming back in part because of disruptions in care due to the COVID pandemic, disruptions in drug supply. And so as a result, it's just, you know, making its way back into being the leading infectious disease killer worldwide.
Based on the history and what we know, what happens next? Does it get worse before it gets better, or how do we go about containing it?
That's such a good question. TB can reside in a person for months and years without becoming clinically problematic. And unfortunately, that tends to indicate that it might get worse before it gets better, especially as we continue to manage the post-COVID TB problem.
Well, meaning that, like, if we don't contain it outside the U.S., it potentially could then infiltrate, if you want to use that word, in the U.S.?
Definitely, especially with international commerce. You know, it is a it is a global disease. It is often in people that don't even realize that they have the disease, like I said, for months or years. So in an international economy, we're always going to be challenged with TB in our borders, in all borders, regardless.
Do you see a point when, I don't want to say necessarily in the U.S., but other countries will sit there and say, you have to have X, Y, and Z vaccine or some sort of protection before they let you in the country?
You know, interestingly, Ellis Island and other historical immigration sites would have TB screening before letting immigrants into the United States. So it's not uncommon to think about that. But just recognize that that never resulted in control. Again, a lot of people have the infection without having any signs or symptoms. So a screening program is not going to reduce transmission and can actually, you know, cause a lot more struggle and strife than necessary. So it just is, it's one of those diseases where really we have to identify ways to diagnose it before it's infectious and contagious. And then we do have great antibiotic therapies that can then cure TB as long as we get people, you know, early and consistently on a drug regimen.
Professor, thanks so much for the time and for the information and for the research. Karen Dobos is microbiology professor at Colorado State. She is also director of the CSU Regional Biocontainment Lab. Woolly mammoths have been gone for a long time, but a little bit of them are having a comeback in the form of woolly mice. New research in the field of de-extinction is making strides with more possible in the future. For more, we're joined on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline by Beth Shapiro, Chief Science Officer at Colossal Labs and Biosciences. Thanks very much for the time.
Thanks for inviting me.
Okay.
Good news, maybe.
So woolly mice, right? You know, on one hand, I feel like, okay, if they're pocket-sized, it's okay, but like when they're marching down the middle of the street, I'm not so sure. I feel great about that.
Well, these mice are not going to be giants. So they're just tiny little adorable creatures living out their lives in our vivarium at Colossal.
And why do this?
You know, one of the hardest problems that we face on the path to making a mammoth is to figure out how different changes in the DNA map to the way an animal looks. And so we have to take an Asian elephant, the closest living relative of a mammoth, and turn it into a woolly elephant, if you will. And while we can try a lot of different things in culture in the lab, sometimes it's nice to have a whole animal model so we can make these edits and see, did that change actually make it woollier? And in the case of the mouse, the answer is yes.
And how are these mice doing?
They're doing great. I was really interested in learning whether they just spend a lot more time grooming themselves than regular mice, because they really do have really long, curly, woolly hair. But, you know, the people who are working in the lab say they're just like regular mice. They're just sitting around, chilling, and running on their wheel, hiding under their little house. They're just much cuter than a regular lab mouse. That's pretty much it.
I'm getting a little Jurassic Park vibe here. Yeah, and wondering whether or not, like, it's going to go further, and then also the ethical question about, you know, if we, just because we can, should we?
We do get Jurassic Park a lot, but, you know, I think what I like about the Jurassic Park question, which we always get, is that, you know, in Jurassic Park, they weren't making, you know, dinosaurs by getting dinosaur DNA and piecing them together. It's also not what we're doing here. We're learning what it is to take ancient DNA from mammoths, and then what is the key trait of a mammoth? And mammoths are big and they're woolly and they're able to live in a different habitat. They can move around and distribute seeds and dig up the soil. They create these rich mosaic landscapes that don't exist in the Arctic anymore. And the goal of all of our de-extinction projects is to reestablish these missing parts of ecosystems. So do we need mammoths? Maybe not, but it would be nice to have a cold-tolerant elephant that could live in a different part of the world. What we definitely need, though, are these tools. Every species that is a candidate for de-extinction faces a different set of technical and ethical and ecological challenges. And as we solve them, the tools that we develop, the protocols we develop, the collaborations we bring together can immediately be applied to helping living species avoid extinction. Now, I know people are worried about biotechnology. You've already said Jurassic Park, and I get that too. But we also have to think that if we choose not at least to explore what these tools might be able to provide, that's also making a decision, and it also has consequences. We see that more than 50% of species right now are threatened with extinction. We're not claiming that this is a technology that should be used instead of traditional conservation, but it should be something that we think about using in addition to traditional approaches. We all want a future that is biodiverse, and thinking about Jurassic Park, thinking about mammoths, getting people excited, making people realize that the extinction crisis is real and this is a solution, I think it's good news. And the woolly mouse are just an adorable little manifestation of that positivity.
They really are. They really are. But if I hear you right, it sounds like, you know, ultimately you could create a species that would survive better in a changing climate.
That's the goal, right? Habitats around the planet are changing faster than evolution can keep up. What we're hoping to do is develop tools that can help species be resistant to diseases that have been introduced, or you know, replace genetic diversity that's been lost because populations have become really small. Gene editing could be a really promising tool to help species survive in the habitats of tomorrow.
Fascinating and adorable research at the same time. Beth Shapiro, Chief Science Officer at Colossal Labs and Biosciences.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it. That's why I go for a five-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or whenever my favorite team is playing late. 5-Hour Energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before tip-off.
The Women's Hoop Show, a podcast hosted by me, Jordan Robinson, brings you fresh women's basketball voices and breakdowns every week. I'll be joined by hoop experts all year long. Find the Women's Hoop Show on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
A commercially built moon lander is expected to touch down on the lunar South Pole in a couple of hours. For the latest on this, we're joined live on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline by Tarek Malik, editor-in-chief at space.com. And thanks for joining us. So this is the Artemis program. What's the goal here?
Yeah, well, this is actually a really interesting kind of a twofer, because we actually already had a Firefly Blue Ghost Moonlander land on the moon on Sunday. Now, Intuitive Machines, another private company that NASA has contracted, is going to land at the South Pole of the moon, and it's kind of doing a little bit of everything. It's carrying a drill to hunt for ice at this this region. It's the first to try to land there successfully, and it has a little rover, a hopping robot, a bunch of commercial payloads too, this company is excited because their first mission tipped over on the moon, so they want it as a success today.
So where does it stand now? Let's hope it doesn't tip over this time.
No, so as we're talking, this lander, it's called Athena, it is about 2 hours from landing on the moon and about 1 hour from firing its thrusters to leave lunar orbit. It's been there for a little bit. It only launched a week ago today, so it's a very quick mission as opposed to a few others. And we're all just kind of waiting to find out if they're going to be able to make it this time. This company, Intuitive Machines, is a commercial company that is hoping not just to fly missions to the moon for NASA, but for other companies. They're carrying Nokia's first cell tower for the moon on this flight, as well as a private server to be, like a computer data storage server on the moon for a company called Lone Star. So quite a few different innovative things. I'm really excited about the hopping robot called Grace, which is going to hop around like a frog on the moon, hopefully after it lands.
So you can go to the moon and say, "Can you hear me now?" That's great.
Exactly.
What's special about the South Pole of the moon?
Well, the South Pole is a destination not just for a lot of commercial companies, but for NASA in particular. They want to send their Artemis astronauts, as you mentioned there, by 2027. And it's interesting for a few reasons. Number one, we've never been there before. It's a very kind of alien environment for us to explore. It also has these permanent shadowed craters on the moon, places that never see daylight. And NASA has found evidence that there is ice, water ice, just kind of sitting there, either on the surface or buried in the rock there. And that's what one of the instruments, NASA's Prime 1 drill on this spacecraft, is going to look for. After landing, if it's successful, it will start to drill deep into the surface looking for that ice, because if it's there, astronauts could use it for water, for oxygen, even for to make rocket fuel once they start landing there and building up a base.
I'm curious about the privatization, these companies that are going. We had Firefly Aerospace, and now we have Intuitive Machines. What is the business atmosphere going to be like for the moon in the coming years?
Well, NASA is a key customer for these missions. In fact, another company in Japan called iSpace has their own spacecraft called Resilience on its way to the moon. It will arrive sometime in June right now. And so these companies are finding that they can serve NASA's needs. NASA doesn't have to build the spacecraft themselves. They can be a customer. They can say, we'd like you to fly this instrument or that tool to do some reconnaissance or whatnot. And these companies can build that and then find other customers. Like we mentioned, Nokia with their cell tower, Lone Star with their server. There's also, I believe, an MIT and Lunar Outpost rover on this lander too, that they want to test their technology for their own future missions. So they're finding that there are other people that want this kind of access beyond NASA, and they're trying to make a business case for that as this lunar economy heats up.
This is kind of an intricate, complex maneuver to get it in position to land on the moon. First, you got to drop, 4,000 miles an hour in speed?
Oh, yeah. They are going to have to be slowing down very quickly. In fact, much of this is probably going to be autonomous as well. One of the things that Intuitive Machines learned on their first launch, which was actually last year on their first Athena probe landing, Nova C, was to make sure their autonomous landing systems are really refined to the point where they can control the spacecraft on the way down. That spacecraft landed a little bit hard, a little bit faster than they thought, and the terrain was a bit tougher, so that it's one of its legs kind of caught on a rock and it tipped over after landing. They got a few minutes worth of data on their commercial payloads, but they wanted to get more. And so for this one, they're making sure that their systems are all set so that the navigation is set, the hazard avoidance systems are set so that they can recognize those threats as they land and make sure they touch down as gingerly as they can so that they don't tip over this time.
Thank you so much for making time for us this morning. That is Tarek Malik, the editor-in-chief at space.com.
Subscribe to the All Local wherever you get your podcasts and stream us on your smart speaker 24/7 by saying, play KCBS Radio.